You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at the role of veterans in American presidential races. First, with the Winter Olympics wrapping up last Sunday, we're now looking ahead to the 2018 Paralympic Winter Games, which begin on March 9th. In our continuing coverage of Wisconsin Olympians, WPR's Maureen McCollum recently spoke with Mia Zutter, a native of Sun Prairie, who's competing at the Games in cross-country skiing and biathlon. Maureen also talked to Mia's doctor, David Gamm, about Stargardt disease. That's a degenerative eye condition that Zutter was diagnosed with in 2011. We'll first hear from Dr. Gamm and then Mia Zutter.
So, Dr. Gamm, I'm wondering if you can talk about the first time you met Mia.
So that was, I believe it was 2012, and Mia and her family came in, and all I knew at the time was that she was having difficulty with her vision. And I immediately knew something was significantly wrong when I walked in the room, sat down, and started talking to her. And that's because folks who have problems with the center portion of their vision, such that when they look directly at something, it disappears, they tend to have what's called eccentric fixation, meaning that they look slightly away from the object of regard in order to see it. And so when she was looking at me, I could tell that she was really not looking directly at me, but kind of at my ear. And that's a bit of a dead giveaway that there's something going wrong in the center of the retina. So that told me immediately that something was up. And in a person of her age, one of the main causes of that is an entity called Stargardt disease.
It's just like that center field of vision just disappears, and it's almost like the side parts just come together?
Exactly.
Wow.
So if you were to, say, look at a clock straight on, but the clock itself isn't necessarily totally gone, like a black hole in the center of your vision, but exceedingly blurred. And first thing people think about is, well, look away. But the problem is that follows you wherever you go, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's fixed. So that center portion of your vision, which is the most crucial part of your eyesight, just think, try to read a book looking at the edge of the book. But in children who have Stargardt, it happens gradually over time, and it's remarkable how it can go unnoticed, both to the individual who has the problem as well as to the family, because they adapt so well. I mean, children are resilient, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they don't really know anything different. And oftentimes they'll just say, well, I thought everybody saw this way.
Then what was it like working with her, you know, in the years after that, just in learning how to kind of deal with this?
Well, I mean, the remarkable thing about Mia and her family was, you know, when we did the testing there in the office, just to confirm what our suspicion was, you know, in some respects, I remember kind of saying, well, I've got, you know, kind of good news and bad news. And the bad news is there really is a problem. I mean, you kind of knew that when you came in here because you had failed some vision tests and knew something was going wrong. The good news is that it's pretty much almost fully affected you at this point. There may be some additional vision loss down the line that you might experience, but it was pretty far along at the time that I met her. Yet look at what she was already doing. I mean, she's one excellent student, mm-hmm. very active. And I said, so in some respects, I'm giving you a diagnosis today, but you didn't, it's not like today is when all this started. It's, you've been, you know, you've already demonstrated a remarkable resiliency. You know, Mia, really, just keep doing what you're doing. This doesn't change anything, really, in terms of your trajectory. You've already set yourself on such a wonderful path, and you've met so many goals. There's no reason to put a damper on any of that.
So with Stargardt disease, it's kind of carry on as you have been, but then are there, like, are there surgeries, are there things that, like, the medical field can do to correct
no.
it?
No, yeah, that's the issue. It's a genetic disorder which affects only her vision, so it doesn't affect any other part of her physiology whatsoever. But there is a lot of work being done to try and help individuals, and there's a great deal of hope now going forward in a number of different experimental areas that we work on here at the McPherson Eye Research Institute and at the University of Wisconsin. And these vary from actually trying to repair the gene defect itself, if we can get to it early enough, or replacing the cells in the retina, the photoreceptor cells and the helper cells of the photoreceptors, the rods and cones, and try to actually replace them using stem cell technology.
Wow.
And we're doing a lot of really cutting-edge research in those areas. They're not ready for prime time at this point, but we're moving ahead at a safe but expeditious pace. And I think patients like Mia will have options in the foreseeable future. But in the meantime, it's no reason to slow down or modify your goals, as Mia shows.
Right. I was going to say, case in point with Mia.
don't wait for us, in other words, right? We're working for you. We're working really hard.
Yeah.
We want to help you. But in the meantime, do your thing.
Yeah. So will you be watching Mia compete?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Yes. This doesn't come along every very often. And I suspect it won't be the first time either to watch Mia do something pretty spectacular.
So, Mia, tell us about how you got started with Nordic skiing.
Yeah, for sure. So I ran cross-country and track almost all the way through high school. I didn't run track my junior and senior year, but I ran cross-country all 4 years. And then before losing my vision, I was a figure skater. So I always kind of liked the, balance and, grace of that, but I really liked endurance also. So when I first was introduced to skiing, or the idea of it, I was really against it just because I was so into running at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And my parents were the ones who kind of were like, you can't just not try it. Like, at least try it first. So then I tried roller skiing for the first time, which is like the summer cross training form of skiing.
Sure.
And I loved it. It was like rollerblading and it kind of reminded me of figure skating. My first time on the snow was shortly after my first, it was probably a month after my first time roller skiing, and I was like, this is my perfect sport. Just instantly, I was like, I want to be good. I will be good at this.
So do you remember, like, what it was, like, in that moment when it just, like, the light bulb went off and you were like, oh, my God, this is so for me?
It's so much faster than running because you're gliding. So it's got kind of, like, a gracefulness to it, which I missed from figure skating. But it was also just, like, exhausting, and I have always loved endurance sports, and yeah, it was just kind of my perfect like hybrid of the two sports. So then when I had found this new sport that I just loved, I was just like, I can make this what I want, like what I want it to be. And in my first year skiing, I got to watch a Paralympic World Cup in Cable, Wisconsin, and that was like my first experience seeing these disabled athletes and how they're doing a sport with their adaptations and how it's a competitive sport. And that's like, I love sports for fun, but I'm a very competitive person. So seeing what it like that this could be like a professional athlete setting was like the dream for me. So ever since seeing that World Cup, I just knew like I wanted to be on that team and like in these races.
And now you've made the Paralympic team. Congratulations. That's super exciting.
Thank you.
So back in 2011, you were diagnosed with Stargardt's disease. And I'm wondering if you can describe for people who don't have this, like, what it's like for you visually?
So throughout these last almost seven years, I have lost all of my central vision, but it's not black like people expect blindness to be. It's more of, like, I kind of explain it as, like, sea glass, how it's so fogged, like, you can't see through it, but you can get light through it. And then I have my peripheral vision, which is blurry just because it's not meant for like precise seeing.
Mm-hmm.
So that I solely use my peripheral vision.
So at what point when you were in either middle school or high school and these changes were coming upon you, did you say like, this is not going to hold me back whatsoever?
I think it was when in seventh grade, when I went out for track the first time, because I did it because my older sister did it and I want to be her.
Yeah.
But just, like, how I was doing this sport with a guide, competing in these meets like the rest of my classmates, but I was doing well. Like, I was beating girls, and I'm competitive, so that feels good. And just, like, realizing that, I'm still a fast runner despite the situation, I just was like, well, I can be an athlete just like anyone else. So that was really empowering for me, just having the support from my family, like, I mean, my parents being scared of what this would mean for my future, but then still, like, wanting me to have a normal upbringing, like, I think that was really crucial to, like, this whole situation that I'm in now and, like, being on the Paralympics team.
And then once you're over there, are you setting any expectations for yourself?
Who doesn't want a medal?
Right.
But just based on my past World Cups and where I'm falling, I don't want to put pressure on myself to medal just because it is my, like, first Paralympics. And my goal this year was to qualify. So I'm already relaxed. I kind of reached my goal, and now it's just that you've earned this, you get to go, is kind of all I'm focused on. But definitely looking for a medal in Beijing in 4 years. So.
I was going to say, you're so young. Like, I'm sure many people will be expecting to see you as the years go on.
Yeah, and that's what I love about skiing is it doesn't really have a time limit. Like, yeah. My competitors, some of them are, like, upper 30s, 40s. Like, so it's really a really cool sport that can last for so long. It's a marathon, not a sprint.
Well, congratulations and best of luck, and we'll all be cheering for you back here.
Oh, thank you.
That was WPR's Maureen McCollum talking with Dr. David Gamm and Mia Zutter, a Sun Prairie native who's competing at the upcoming Paralympic Winter Games in the cross-country skiing and biathlon events. Military veterans have played a big role in American politics since the beginning when General George Washington became President George Washington. Since then, military service at various levels has been a key part of presidential campaigns, from generals like Harrison, Grant, and Eisenhower to lower-ranked officers like Kennedy, McCain, and Dole. But are veterans really more engaged in politics, and does a military background appeal to voters in races for president and Congress? Our next guest tackled those questions in his new book. Jeremy Tigan is a professor of political science at Ramapo College and author of the new book, Why Veterans Run, Military Service in American Presidential Elections, 1789 to 2016. He's also a UW-Madison graduate. Jeremy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, you look back at a couple hundred years of presidential elections, and one thing that really stands out is veterans are overrepresented among the presidential candidates. They're more likely to run than the general populace.
Absolutely. Approximately a little bit more than half of the 70-some major party presidential nominees have had some kind of military service, and that is a vast numerical overrepresentation, if you just sort of think of it in numerator-denominator terms. There's a lot of veterans in politics, not only in presidential elections as well as down-ballot races, but more than half of presidential candidates have, you're right.
And we've posted a question on our Ideas Network Facebook page. It's, are you more likely to vote for a veteran? And Jeremy, I know the answer to this question is different from era to era, year to year. But in general, does military service help, let's say, a presidential candidate in particular?
That's a great question. And it sort of depends on when you ask. And it depends on what context you ask. If you're asking, is there a blanket general advantage that veterans enjoy in the general election? The answer is no. There's not a systematic, for example, 5 percentage point gain that military veterans would enjoy over a similarly situated non-veteran. And think about it, if there were, we'd have 535 members of Congress with military experience. Parties would nominate no one else. I looked at a decade of U.S. House elections and as well as a half century of presidential elections, and there just isn't a quantitative advantage that's systematic and over time. Now, there's no doubt, though, that particular candidates in particular contexts have been helped by military service in various ways. There's no doubt that some candidates have used their military service to, gain name recognition and establish themselves, maybe rise above a larger pack within their own party. And there's no doubt that parties nominate them far more often than you'd expect numerically.
Going up to the 1800s, especially before the Civil War, once that first generation of founding fathers stopped running for office, it seems like a lot of politics was at the state level, and maybe being a war hero, having that military experience, was the one way or a good way to get a national name recognition for a candidate. Is that right?
Absolutely. In the antebellum period, Andrew Jackson is really a prototype for a lot of presidential candidates that followed especially for the fairly short-lived Whig Party. You know, Andrew Jackson and William Henry Harrison, Zach Taylor, Winfield Scott. These are individuals who, transcended their local politics and were able to use their military experience to gain name recognition in virtually the only way possible outside of politics in order to make a lateral entry to a White House run.
And how about after the Civil War? What did it may have depended on which side you had military experience on.
Indeed. There were no, for example, former Confederate generals vying for a race like that. The post Civil War years were another pattern, and I organized the book around post war periods for a very good reason, and that's that the patterns of military veteran emergence in presidential elections is reflected by the large previous conflict. And so these individuals that ran for the new Republican Party after Lincoln, starting with Ulysses Grant, most of them were men who, wore a Civil War uniform during the war and were likely to be high-ranking officers. You know, your Rutherford B. Hayes, your Garfield, and even the Democrats tried with Gettysburg hero Winfield Scott Hancock. And the post-Civil War years were probably the most the area where partisan politics was most aligned with military experience. And that's because the Civil War was extremely unique. It's hard to, compare even to our wars with other countries because, the Civil War was a partisan conflict that was engaged with bullets instead of ballots. And those Republicans, basically campaigned on the fact that they had fought for the Republican and Northern side to reintegrate the Union, and the Democratic Party was, of course, the other one. And so they like to what was called wave the bloody shirt and remind voters with a very easy to consume cue that they represent the party and have the personal experience to legitimate their candidacy.
Talking to historian Jeremy Tigan about his book, Why Veterans Run. I want to fast forward, Jeremy, to the post-Vietnam era, because this seems like an issue that comes up again and again. Did someone serve? Did they get deferments all the way up to the most recent presidential election?
Sorry, one correction, Rob. All the historians in your listening range probably just did a facepalm. I'm a mere political scientist.
A political scientist. I'm sorry. You're writing about history in your book, though.
That's fair enough. Fair enough. The post-Vietnam era, if you sort of take Bill Clinton through Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, was really a sharp break from the previous pattern. If you sort of pool the men who were born in the 19-teens, 1920s, who would form the, what Tom Brokaw called the greatest generation from, more or less, Eisenhower, Nixon, and Kennedy through Bob Dole, they were all born in a very relatively narrow period. They all had a very similar early life military experience and went on to grab the lower rungs of political ladders in their state. And almost all of them, only Hubert Humphrey didn't have military service. But for the Vietnam sort of generation, these folks from Bill Clinton and Al Gore through Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, military service became actually more salient in elections, despite the fact that there were fewer people with military service, because the politics of who served, who didn't, and why became a repeated question in these presidential campaigns. Think back to how in 1996, when John Kerry tried to make his military service in Vietnam a very central aspect of his campaign. In fact, he held the Democratic National Convention was held in Boston. He rode on a boat towards the convention hall and, started his speech with a salute that he's reporting for duty. And, they did this in a wartime election, trying to, show the American voter that the Democratic Party also held credibility on national defense and security issues. And, Republican allied groups perceived that this was the Democratic Party's greatest strength and, went on to, with the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth campaign, attack him on that very point that they'd worked so hard to cultivate an advantage.
And Jeremy, briefly, as we wrap up, your book focuses on presidential races. You've also written about veterans in congressional races this time around. Democrats seem to be recruiting a lot of veterans to run for office this year. Can this be a difference maker in at least some of this year's elections?
It certainly can be. We're a little bit early. We're sort of racing, racing through the news cycle and thinking about, are there a lot of military veterans? And it seems like there are. There's news of military veterans on the Democratic side, sponsored by people like Seth Moulton of Massachusetts, a House member who's also a Iraq War combat vet, who's made a pact to support Democratic veterans across the country. So it seems like it's very newsworthy. But we sort of need to sort of step back. This isn't really a sprint. This is more of a slow-speed chase where we're looking towards the primaries. We have to wait till see who emerges from these primaries. But it really feels like there is a notable effort by the Democrats to find Democratic veterans and put them in races where they might be competitive. It's a little early to say. We have some time before we get to the primaries. But not only, military veterans generically, but also some female veterans. In Wisconsin, I noticed that there was a female veteran running against Duffy in the seventh, who had just declared, and the name escapes me, but I want to say that her Twitter handle was oriented right around her military service. So this cycle, it seems like another effort by Democrats to show credibility on national defense and security issues by helping and nominating candidates.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Jeremy Tigan, professor of political science at Ramapo College. His new book is Why Veterans Run: Military Service in American Presidential Elections. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. More and more companies are choosing to take a political stance on political and social issues, most recently, gun control. Over 20 companies known to provide benefits to NRA members have made promises to eliminate those discounts. That includes airlines, insurance companies, and banks on that list after threats of boycotts. Additionally, Dick's Sporting Goods store has released a statement declaring they'll stop selling assault rifles and selling guns for anyone under the age of 21. Walmart is also raising their minimum age for gun purchases. Companies who wish to keep a neutral tone find themselves facing criticism on social media, leaving them in a tough spot. Derek Thompson is a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, labor markets, and the media. His recent piece is Why Are Corporations Finally Turning Against the NRA? Derek, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Well, this is new territory in some ways. I can't remember this widespread corporate movement to dissociate with the NRA. What's going on?
Yeah, so I kind of break it down into four big variables. I think there are four essential reasons why companies are turning against the NRA. Four theories, at least, might be overlapping. The first theory, very basically, is that this is about consumers, because these are businesses, and everything businesses do is about consumers. That they've essentially noticed that even if Republicans seem to dominate politics in the U.S., the White House, Congress, state legislatures, that consumers in the U.S. Tend to be younger and tend to lean a little bit further to the left. So this is about responding to their customers. The second is that maybe this is about not just attracting consumers who might be more liberal, but also recruiting potential employees who might be more liberal. And when you think about the sort of employees that larger Fortune 500 companies want to bring in, they tend to be college graduates, they tend to be young, and indeed we've seen in poll after poll that young college graduates have an overwhelmingly negative impression not only of Trump but also the Republican Party. Number three, I think you could look inside the companies and say, well, maybe the boards of directors, maybe the employees at that company might be leaning left on various issues, including gun control, and for that reason the companies are incentivized to follow their own rank and file. And then number four, maybe the most clever or savvy theory here, is that some of these larger companies that have moved against the NRA, say Delta, United in the airline industry, or Walmart in the retail industry, that these are large companies and relatively consolidated industries that might face antitrust pressure under a future liberal administration. And so in a way, this might be a way to buy favor, to curry favor with liberals today in the hopes that when they gain power in Washington, they don't try to break up these companies or punish them with higher taxes. So you put all of that together, you can say, A, they're doing it for the consumers, B, they're doing it for the recruits, C, they're doing it for the boards of directors, or D, this is a long game strategy to prepare for a future of liberal governance.
Let's take a look at A for a moment, the idea that this is to appeal to consumers. There's people trying to have a boycott. They don't want their brand maybe associated with a controversial organization. But any decision they make like this is going to anger another group of consumers, namely NRA members.
That is exactly right. Yeah, I mean, you could say that, you know, the NRA only has a few million, maybe 3 to 5 million members. You know, United flies, I think, 140 million people every year. So if you do the arithmetic, you could say that, well, this is it is a risk worth taking. But I think the interesting question embedded in your query is, why is it such a risk? I think what you're seeing today is that there's this enormous politicization of the public sphere, and it's forcing nonpartisan companies to take partisan stands. And it doesn't just start with the NRA, it doesn't just start with guns. We saw this in the gay marriage debate. Over 400 companies filed an amicus brief in 2015 urging the Supreme Court to legalize same-sex marriage. You saw it with the immigration debate. Hundreds of executives, many of them from tech companies, signed a letter last year that urged the president to protect Dreamers, undocumented workers brought to the U.S. as children. When North Carolina passed its transgender bathroom law, the NCAA announced that they were going to pull its college basketball tournament from the state, and other companies similarly withdrew their business. So you know, I could keep listening, but I don't want to bore the listeners. The point is, this isn't just about guns. This is about guns and transgender rights and immigrants and the future of gay marriage. This is about a lot of issues where companies have essentially come down rather far to the left on social issues of the Republican Party, and that has forced them in some ways to fight back against Republican policies.
So why is that different now? Groups on the left and right have tried boycotting different companies over the years and decades, and, you know, with success sometime, with little success other times. Why this movement? Why now?
Yeah, so I think let's just first take this particular NRA debate, because I don't know yet that I have a universal theory of why companies suddenly become activists in political debates. But I think that if you look at a combination of demographics plus a spark, a certain catalyst, that gets you a long way toward a universal theory. So the demographics of the U.S. are such that even though older, more conservative Americans tend to control politics, it's younger, more liberal Americans who are either richer or about to become the major consumers in the economy. And because of that generational schism, it can be a little bit confusing looking back and forth from politics to corporate America deciding, is America conservative on social issues? You look to politics, you say yes. You look to companies, you say no, and back and forth. The other thing, though, that's happened clearly with regard to the NRA and this debate that we've had after the Parkland shooting is the teenage response, the response of these remarkable teenagers in Florida has, I think, been an incredible catalyst for a social media rebellion against the NRA that has very effectively pressured a handful of companies to change their policies, particularly on sponsoring NRA members. And that once you have a couple of these large companies that have made a decision, like United and Delta and some of the car rental companies, that it pressures other companies in that industry, in the travel industry, let's say, to make a decision, to say, all right, we have to decide whether or not we're going to stand with the NRA, essentially, or follow where everyone else in our industry is going. And people, a lot of these companies essentially have decided that it's safer to follow.
Talking to Derek Thompson from The Atlantic, looking at corporations cutting ties with the NRA and some retail outlets changing their policies on selling guns. One of those companies, Dick's Sporting Goods, they released a memo saying they're not going to sell assault-style weapons. They're no longer going to sell firearms to people under 21 years of age, no longer going to sell high-capacity magazines, and they called on elected officials to enact, quoting here, common-sense gun reform. Here's a listen to CEO of Dick's. This is Ed Stack on Good Morning America talking about the move.
And we know that this isn't going to make everyone happy, but when we take a look at what those kids and the parents and the heroes in the school, what they did, And our view was if the kids can be brave enough to organize like this, we can be brave enough to take these out of here.
So is this part of maybe the board of directors angle you were talking about earlier, Derek? This is actually a company examining their thoughts and their values and making a decision?
Yeah, it's a little bit of that. I guess I want to call your attention and listeners' attention to two words in that comment. The first is kids. The first is the fact that these teenagers have really been a remarkable political force, and they have brought pressure on the NRA that is relatively unprecedented in modern American history. He mentioned them because they're top of mind, and they're top of mind because they've been unbelievably effective. The second word that I want to call your attention to is the word brave. He called the kids brave, and I think that's an understatement, but he also called the company brave. And that's really interesting because he's essentially trying to signal that this isn't just about them following. This isn't just about them capitulating to public pressure. This is about them taking a stand and saying this decision aligns with our values. And so I think that on the one hand, you could say, you know, if I were a business school professor, I might say, every company needs to be able to write down its purpose on an index card, and every decision, right, like just has to click back to that purpose. That's sort of the classic sort of corporate leadership philosophy, that your company doesn't just stand for a bottom line, it also stands for something above that bottom line, values. But as a more cynical journalist, I would say, he is signaling bravery in order to get people in the left of center and liberals in America who are critical of the NRA to compliment the company. They've essentially made the decision that there is a cultural war going on right now around the issue of guns, and they will win if they advertise themselves as aligning with the liberal cause, as aligning with the gun control cause. And so this clicks right back, I guess, not only to the third thing that I mentioned at the top of the segment about how these moves reflect the sentiment of boards and employees, but the fourth thing that I said, which is that in many ways these companies are virtue signaling. They are doing their best to say, you know, we don't just stand for bottom line. This is our way of communicating an element of corporate social responsibility. And so I think that you're seeing a lot of that as well. A lot of these companies are not just quietly making these decisions. They're trying to wrap up these decisions as a kind of corporate bravery.
Derek Thompson is with us, senior editor at The Atlantic. His recent piece is Why Are Corporations Finally Turning Against the NRA? We're seeing companies cutting discounts for NRA members, changing their policies on gun sales. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think when you see an airline, a bank, an insurance company, whatever, publicly saying we're no longer going to have these NRA discounts, taking a stance on this issue or other issues? What do you think about Walmart's and Dick's, each offering different reasons, changing their gun sale policies? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Derek Thompson is with us, senior editor at The Atlantic. We're talking about the corporate response to the latest firearms debate since the mass shooting at a Florida school. A lot of businesses are ending their discount programs or other associate deals for NRA members, and some retailers are changing their policies on what guns they'll sell and what age you need to be to buy them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you used an NRA discount for an airline or insurance company? What do you think of the idea of companies distancing themselves and publicly announcing it when they distance themselves from the NRA? Should companies be more or less involved in social issues? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. To your calls now, Charlie is with us in Milwaukee. Charlie, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I guess the question I have is that with all these companies that are doing things, I think there's a whole group of people who might be fiscally conservative yet socially liberal. There aren't a lot of candidates who fit that bill, and you're almost forced to choose one or the other, and it only contributes to the hyper-partisanship that is going on right now. Is there a chance that we could have someone who is a little more moderate or able to compromise on these things so that if you do have conservative views on one thing, you don't have to take the whole bag and be able to compromise a little more?
Charlie, thanks for the call. I don't want to go too far into the election politics here, but Derek, he said fiscally conservative, socially liberal, and it seems like that's where a lot of companies are ending up these days.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Exactly what I was going to say, which is that companies themselves are exactly that. They are fiscally conservative, which is to say in as much as they want taxes cut, they want regulations cut, they want anything that allows them to maximize their bottom line, their cash flow. On the other hand, we do see that increasingly a lot of these Fortune 500 companies are what you would have to call socially liberal. They stand on the side of gay marriage, they support transgender rights, and now they are increasingly standing up against the NRA. I would define that position as being fiscally conservative but socially liberal. But it turns out that when you try to run on a platform of fiscal conservatism and social liberalism, it doesn't get you that far. It doesn't get you that far because the Republican Party is not socially liberal. So, all right, you can't run as a Republican. Donald Trump won in many ways explicitly because he is not socially liberal, because he is essentially, a traditionalist, a reactionary. And then on the left, Bernie Sanders was he pulled Hillary Clinton to the left on economic issues because the promise of higher taxes and universal health care, potential Medicare for all, was so attractive to so many people because they're so concerned about inequality. So on the left, it seems like fiscal liberalism was the winning formula in 2016, and on the right, it seems like social conservatism is the winning issue. So in a way, to have the corporatist position here that the caller identified is a losing platform in both parties. It's not to say that a Michael Bloomberg style candidate couldn't potentially be successful in some future presidential election. I think 2016 taught us above all to be circumspect about our ability to predict the future. But that said, I don't see any that either of the parties right now are receptive to that kind of message.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Go next to Kika in McFarland. Hi.
Oh, hi. Yes, I keep thinking that there is a parallel with the NRA and the tobacco industry back when it was identified the tobacco was a dangerous product for society. And I see that NRA has a dangerous product, for society, and that the same way that the health industry came forward pressing, legislation and change at that time to make that recognized, I think that these companies now are kind of doing the same thing. And for that reason, they deserve our respect and our admiration.
Kika, thanks for the call. Do you see those parallels? Tobacco industry of the past, the gun industry of today, Derek?
It's hard to say. On the one hand, let me be extremely unhelpful and give you an on the one hand, on the other hand answer. On the one hand, we have seen that American attitudes and social issues can change relatively quickly. They changed seemingly overnight on gay marriage. They have changed radically in the last 10 years on marijuana. So gay marriage and marijuana do suggest that Americans can change their mind relatively quickly. And maybe that will happen with guns. Maybe it's happening right now. On the other hand, guns are different than every other product in the United States. They're different than marijuana. They're different than tobacco. They're different from cars. And that's because enshrined in the Bill of Rights, right there after the number two, we have an amendment guaranteeing every American's right to own a firearm. I have my own issues with the Second Amendment. We don't need to go into them. But the bottom line is that the Second Amendment is there. And amendments are incredibly sticky. Overturning them is quite an ordeal. So that amendment isn't going anywhere anytime soon. And as long as it isn't going anywhere, as long as tens of millions of Americans equate their definition of American freedom with the ability to own a firearm, and relatively any firearm at that, even if it's a military-style weapon, once you have that enshrined in the Constitution and in the American concept of its own freedoms, it becomes very difficult, I think, to extract that. So I gave you a very unhelpful, on the one hand, on the other hand, answer, but I'm probably going to fall into the second category and say that despite all of these changes, you don't see Walmart saying, you know, we're not going to sell any more guns. You have them saying, we're not going to sell any guns to people who can't legally drink alcohol. That's essentially the bargain that they've struck.
Kika, thanks for that call. Derek, I want to quote from your piece here on this. You write, corporations are becoming more democratic than democratic governance itself, end quote there, because they're the ones, they respond faster to public opinion, political outcries. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. I mean, it just seems to me that when you look at a lot of public polls about, you know, gun policy or tax policy or even immigration policy, that American majoritarian attitudes just aren't reflected in representative government. Americans are more positive toward immigrants' impact on the economy than ever, than in the history of polls. And yet we have a president who's trying to cut legal immigration by half. The same thing is happening with tax policy. Americans essentially want to raise taxes on the rich, and the Republican corporate tax cut did the opposite. So if you just look at politics, you'd have to say democracy isn't working, or at least democracy isn't, I'm not suggesting that elections are illegitimate, but that the attitudes of Americans aren't being reflected in its leaders. But then, you look at business, and, you know, businesses have to respond to the public, to the polity, to the democratic whims, as stupid or wise as they may be, relatively immediately. Every week, as I wrote in the piece, is essentially a political primary for a consumer brand. You can lose consumer share just like that at the drop of a hat. And so whereas a lot of politicians, I think, assume they can wait out the outrage, assume that maybe they can pass a tax policy that the majority of Americans don't like by winning votes on a message of anti-immigration and sort of culture war fighting. A lot of, I think, companies don't have that same ability to just blame the other side. They have to respond to the immediacy of demand, and for that reason, I think one could defend a cheeky statement such as the one that I made, which is that, ironically, American companies have become more democratic than democratic governance.
Derek, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, labor markets, and the media. He joined us to talk about the recent wave of companies taking a stance in the gun debate. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, campaign staffs aren't usually unionized, but that may be starting to change. We'll find out why one Wisconsin congressional campaign is on a short list of union shops. There was a big rise in reports of anti-Semitic incidents in 2017. We'll look at the details and some of the possible causes. And on this week's edition of Food Friday, we'll get over any fears of baking that are holding us back in the kitchen. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow after 6, Kate and her guests look at some of the best places to get a Wisconsin fish fry and ask for your favorites, too. That's tomorrow morning after 6 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then the White House addressed the opioid crisis today. We'll talk to a Wisconsin doctor about what policies could help bring down the number of opioid-related deaths in the state and across the country. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for your support. Did you remember to submit a matching gift form to your employer? You already know that your support helps pay for the great radio programs you enjoy every day. A matching gift from your employer also helps pay for those programs. How great is that? To see if your company matches, go to wpr.org/support and click matching gifts, or check with your HR department. Thanks for the extra support.
All the awesome PBS Kids shows that children love are now available 24 hours a day on the Wisconsin PBS Kids 24/7 channel.
I want to tell you a little bit about it.
Yes! Whenever and wherever the children in your life are seeking fun, educational television, Wisconsin Public Television is there for you.
That's right!
Watch over the air or stream it free anytime, anywhere at WPT.org.
I'm glad you're my friend. Agamaga!